All right. Well, as I said, we're picking up this week in chapter 43 of Genesis, as we make our way through the Bible, one chapter at a time, one verse at a time. Before we dive into chapter 43, I'm going to do like a kind of a review of the story that that we've been continuing here. We've been looking at the life of Joseph. And it's quite an amazing story. It's quite an amazing life that he lived. And frankly, I think you would be hard pressed to find a better story, you know, a better novel, a better book, a better real life story than the one that we've been following here with Joseph. It's really exciting, and it evokes, you know, all of our emotions. And it just shows us so many things. It's so very rich. And last week we were looking at this story, we came to the place where there was the 7 years of plenty that Joseph predicted in interpreting the Pharaoh's dream. And that those 7 years passed, and then now the years of famine that he predicted have begun. And the famine was, as we said, it was a very terrible famine. And it was not just localized in Egypt. It also affected the surrounding areas, including Canaan, where his family, where Jacob and all of his brothers and their families lived. And even though Jacob was incredibly blessed by the Lord, we saw how when Jacob left from his uncle Laban, he had many goods and he had a lot of livestock and he was very blessed. But this famine was so strong that it even affected them to the point where they had begun to run out of food, and they knew that they weren't going to be able to last that long without doing something about it. And that's, you know, basically what the Lord was orchestrating. He had all of this planned out. He had to do that in order to bring him where he wanted to bring him, which was to Egypt. And so, you know, in chapter 42, it talks about how everybody knew about the fact that Egypt was the place to go if you wanted grain, and everybody was going there to get grain. But despite that, Joseph's brothers, they weren't in a hurry to go back there. And I think a big part of that had to do with their guilt. You know, they know what they did, right? They know that they sold their brother into slavery. And so they didn't want to go back to the scene of the crime, as it were. And so, you know, they were really hesitant to go there, to the point where their father, Jacob, had to say, look, you know, what are you guys standing here looking at yourself? You guys got to do something. If you don't do something, we're going to die here. And so we see them eventually going ahead and going to Egypt. And the first person they ran into, which is the person who was in charge of all of this, right? All of the entire operation in Egypt of gathering in the grain and preserving it for the time of the famine, and then selling it, deciding who to sell it to, who to distribute it to, and so forth. They run into Joseph, who's this powerful ruler in Egypt, the second in command. It's essentially the prime minister there in Egypt. And the first thing we see that happens is they bow down before him. And so we immediately are able to recognize that that was a fulfillment of God's dream, the dream that he gave to Joseph, basically the promise that he made to Joseph. And so we immediately can recognize that God keeps his promises despite the circumstances, despite, you know, looking at Joseph and saying, man, this guy is, his life is over. You know, he's sold into slavery. He's in prison. You know, he doesn't have a chance, but the Lord will do whatever it takes to keep his promises. And he has the power to keep his promises. So that's one thing that we see. The second thing we see so very strongly is how Joseph begins to put them through a series of tests. And he's really, in essence, he's giving them a taste of their own medicine here. he's bringing back, and the whole point of that is to bring back to their remembrance all the things that they did. But he was really trying to figure out, you know, are his brothers the same as they were before? And so what he does is a combination of things. Number one, he speaks to them roughly. And that reminds us, right, of how they treated him. So you remember when Joseph's father, Jacob, told them to go out and check on the brothers and see how they're doing out there in the field. They were speaking roughly to Joseph. And so he is now speaking roughly to them. The other thing is that they were always looking at Joseph and saying, you're being a spy. You know, you're working for dad. You're spying on us, and you're going back and telling, our father what we're doing. And so he accuses them of being a spy. And this was not a small matter in the situation they were in, right? Because he's basically saying, you're coming out here to see the nakedness of the land. You're kind of trying to size up Egypt to see how you might be able to take it or overtake it or something like that. And so that was a capital crime. Like what he was accusing them of is something that you could get killed for. You can certainly be put into prison, but that's what he does to them. And so they start to feel the pressure here. And so in doing this, in putting this pressure on them, and then eventually he goes ahead and he tells them to bring, you guys said that you have this younger brother, why don't you bring him to me, and I'm going to keep your older brother, and we'll see if you're telling the truth. But in that one sentence, it brings out, right, all of their guilt, right? And he finds out two things that he wanted to know. Number one is he finds out that his younger brother, Benjamin, is still alive. And the second thing is he finds out his father is still alive. And those were two important things for him, because you can imagine that, you know, because of the, you know, how terribly they dealt with Joseph, he probably thought when they left him, they probably went to his brother and probably did the same thing to him. They were going to get rid of him, and you know, they were going to do him in too. So he had many years, right? He had, you know, 13 years of oppression while he was a slave and while he was in prison, to think about all these things and all over in his mind. And there were three things I think he really thought about a lot. One is about the well-being of his brother. Like, is he still alive? How are they treating him? And also about his father. And his well-being. But a third thing was just in his mind, he probably could not get over what his brothers did. And he really is like, why did they do that? Like, how could they do that? What, you know, and you know, probably replaying this in his mind over and over again. And so part of the testing that he's doing is really to see, like, do they have any remorse? You know, are they the same people that they were before? And in fact, he ends up seeing that, right? Because we saw in the latter part of, or let's say the middle part of chapter 42, that after he basically told them, look, you gotta leave your Simeon here, and then you gotta go back and get Benjamin, they started to speak out of their heart, like where they really were. They really did essentially confess that they were guilty. They go like, oh man, we know that, you know, we heard Reuben saying, I told you guys that you shouldn't have done it, that what you did to that young boy. And now we have, his blood is on our hands. And so in that statement, he learns two things important. One is he learns that Reuben wasn't the one he was not involved in what they did. He was trying to talk him out of it. And in fact, he was not there. Secondly, he learns that they think he's dead. When he said that his blood is on our hands, they actually thought that Joseph was dead at this point. And so he learns that. But And so essentially what he's doing here at this, and at this point here, by having, there's a lot of wisdom involved in what he's doing, but the point that he's making to them is that he's saying, if you're really honest men and you're not spies, you will be able to prove that. You will be able to prove that your words are true by going, because you sat here and you said, we're honest men. We come from a family of 12 kids. One of them is not alive anymore. Our father is old and he's back there, and we have another son. And so if they're being truthful and they're not spies, then they should be able to go back, bring the younger son to prove it. And so he really uses all of this to train. He's going to use this to his benefit. It's a strategic play, and we're going to see that as we go further. But one of the other things that we can take from what happened here with these brothers when they were talking about their feelings about, you know, the anguish and everything and the guilt, is that there is a longevity to guilt, and there's a tremendous power of guilt. And, you know, there's a saying, right, that time heals all wounds. But the reality is that time does not heal guilt. If you have a guilty conscience because of something that you've done in the past, but you have, and you have not confessed that sin to the Lord, and you haven't dealt with it, that sin will linger. That sin will continue on, and it will, you know, just grind away at you. So one of the things that needs to happen, as I said, is the way that you deal with guilt is you go to the Lord and you confess it. You say exactly what happened, what you did, and what it is in God's eyes, what you did, not what it is in man's eyes or in your eyes when you are trying to justify yourself, but you say it in the way that God sees it. And then to the extent that there is someone else involved that you harmed in your sin, going to them and confessing that sin and making it right, you know, asking them for forgiveness. That is the way that you deal with sin. And so one of the things that we are seeing here is that not only is God orchestrating all these things for the benefit of Joseph, for the benefit of his father, for the purpose of bringing the Israel to Egypt to grow them into a nation, but he's also here doing something for his brothers. He's giving them the opportunity to have that guilt come out and to be dealt with, you know, once and for all, because they have been carrying that guilt around for a long time, for at least 22 years here. And so we're going to see that, you know, that's going to be dealt with. And what we're also going to see through the tests that Joseph puts them through, that they really are changed men, that they are no longer the heartless, calloused men that they were before. I mean, they were really heartless. I mean, remember how they put Joseph in that pit for all that time, and they were just sitting around just eating, and here Joseph was yelling and crying out to them. But you can tell by what we saw there in the middle of chapter 42 that they really did feel terrible about what they did. The second thing is, and I don't know if I said this just now, but is that in determining that Reuben was not the one who was not involved in what they did, in selling him into slavery and everything, that was a kind of an important point, and that is the reason why Simeon was the one that he kept back and put into prison, okay, or held him while they went back. Because the bottom line is that the oldest son, you know, if you have the sons and any number of them are anywhere doing anything, the oldest son is always the one who is responsible for what takes place. And so the fact that Reuben was not there and was not present, that means that Simeon, who's the second oldest, he was the one who was responsible for what happened. And so therefore he was the one who had to stay back And while they went back to Canaan, back to get Benjamin. And so the two things that Joseph now is going to do that are going to take place and will unfold in chapter 43 is he wants to know what truly is the attitude of these brothers towards his brother Benjamin. You know, are they treating him the same way that they treated Joseph, right? The second one is, what is their attitude towards their father? And if you remember how cruel and callous they were to their father, to just lie to him about what Joseph, what happened to him, you know, to pretend that he was dead, and just to see him there crying and mourning the death of his son, and they're just like, you know, trying to pretend, you know, that they were, you know, comforting him and so forth. So the question he's asking is, you know, what is his attitude towards Benjamin? What is his attitude towards his father? Have these men really changed or haven't them, or have they not? And so in chapter 43, we're going to see him putting them through three or four more tests to see what they're really like. So let's start out and let's read. Let's start to read in chapter 43. So chapter 43, verse 1 reads, "Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, 'Go back and buy us a little food.'" So we can see here that, you know, this is really, this whole situation is working out precisely the way that Joseph planned it to happen. He gave them food to take back to their father's household, but he only gave them a certain amount, right? He didn't give them enough food to last for the entirety of the famine, and he did that on purpose, right? Because he wanted them to come to the end of themselves and realize that they have to go back. He wanted to put them into a pressure cooker. He wanted to get Benjamin back, and he's going to use some leverage points to accomplish that. One of them is just their sheer need, their sheer hunger. And so he gives them enough food for a period of time, but there comes a time when they have to confront the situation and go back. Verse 3 says, or verse 2, we see their father say, "Hey, look, we're running out of grain. You got to do something. Go back and buy a little bit of food. Go back to Egypt and get some food." And here's how Judah responds to this. He says, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.'" And so they basically are reminding their father. When they came back from Egypt, they told their father everything that went on. But they were reminding him. They say, "This guy is serious. He's no joke. I mean, he said, look, I believe that you guys are spies. That is a terrible crime. By right, he should have held all of us in prison, but he only held Simeon. But he just said very clearly to us, if you guys come back and you don't have Benjamin, you're done. So they just said, so the only way we're going to go is if you allow us to take Benjamin. If you don't allow us to take Benjamin, we're not going. And that's precisely what Joseph wanted to effect in them, because he really wanted them to bring Benjamin back. But then verse 6, Israel, he responds and he says, "Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you had still another brother?" So here he's like going, you know, why are you guys, I mean, like, it seems like you guys, you know, keep on making all these mistakes. It's like, Why did you have to offer that up? Why did you have to even tell him that you had a brother? If you didn't tell him, then none of this would even happen. You know, it's like, this is crazy. And so, but then they responded to him, to Jacob, and they said, the man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our family, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? And we told him according to these words. Could we possibly have known that he would say, bring your brother down? And so basically they're saying, look, we you know, we're standing in front of this official. We needed to be truthful. I mean, we were in a, you know, he was accusing us of being spies and being liars and everything else. And so we were acting honestly and acting with integrity, trying to keep ourselves out of trouble. And by the way, like, how are we to know that he was going to say, oh, bring your brother? That was an extraordinary thing. So then in verse 8, we see Judah, he comes forward and he steps up to the plate big time here. Verse 8, it says, then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him, for my hand, from my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me be the blame forever. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we would have returned the second time. And so basically Judah is saying, look, we got to do this. We got to go back. And, you know, if we hadn't, you know, we hadn't been lingering and you know, and wringing our hands about this or whatever, we could have already gone back and gotten, you know, the other grain and come back and you know, resolved everything. But most importantly, he puts himself forward as a surety. And in some ways, you can see, like, we know that the Messiah comes from Judah. And so in a way, he's really acting very much like a redeemer would, in a sense. You know, he has that kind of quality here. And as we talked about last time, how Reuben in verse 37 of chapter 42, how his offer was something that was completely unsatisfying. Basically he's saying, you know, look, if I don't come back, then you can take my sons and kill them. And, you know, for anyone who's a grandfather, that is horrible, right? It's horrid, like, to tell somebody that, if this thing doesn't work out, then you can go and kill your two grandchildren, right? That's just not gonna happen. But here we see Judah, basically, he himself is saying, I'm gonna be the surety. If this doesn't work out, you can hold me accountable, you know, for the rest of my life. You know, I'll bear the blame, you know. And so we see something that that takes place in Israel here. Let's see what it says. Verse 11 says, and their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessel and carry down a present for the man, a little balm and a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. Take double money in your hand and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother also and arise, go back to the man, and may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, and that he may release your older brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. And so here, there's a lot going on here, a lot happening here in Israel. One of the things that we can note right off the bat is we see that Jacob here is being referred to as Israel. And we know that there was a point in time when we talked about how he went through this sanctification process and how he went from being the heel catcher, right? This conniver, this guy who was, you know, self-determined, the guy who was always trying to figure out things himself and to do things based upon his own power and his own intellect and everything. He went from being that Jacob man to being Israel, meaning governed by God. He was one who would be living his life out in the way that God desires for us to live. And we, as Christians, that's the life that we should live, a life that is governed by God. And so from that point on, we see that there are sometimes, especially like right after he first started, after the Lord said he was Israel, he was going kind of back and forth. Some verses he would be referred to as Jacob, some verses he's referred to as Israel. And that too is demonstrating kind of the continuous sanctification process. And because as when we come to Christ and we're Christians, you know, initially, you know, of course we are new creatures. We are governed by God, but we will be kind of flipping back and forth in terms of sometimes we'll be acting in our old nature. We'll be acting in a carnal manner. And then sometimes we'll be acting in a manner where we are, you know, being governed by God. And so in a sense, in this verse here, it's to communicate that what he is saying and what he is doing here, he's acting in the capacity of the man who is governed by God. And so you can see in verse 11, he's telling them to go and to take the best fruits of the land and all this other stuff. And it kind of could remind you of what he was doing with his brother Esau when he was coming to Esau and he was afraid that Esau was angry with him and he was going to kill him or something. And so you can look at this and think, oh, now there he goes again. You know, he's being Jacob, that trying to you know, to connive and to schmooze this man in Egypt. But the reality is that this was something that was common in these times, and that is that when you go before a dignitary, when you go before a man of authority, in order to get their to get them to hear from you, that you would bring a gift. And so that was what he did, was he was basically saying, you know, let's, you know, do this the right way. Go in a very respectful way, bringing a gift. And then number two, in verse 12, he says, take double money in your hand. Again, you could think, oh, he's trying to say, you know, take, you know, try to bribe him or try to, you know, appease him by giving him more money than you have to give him and stuff like that. But in reality, it's just the opposite. What he's saying here, and it's communicated in the last clause where he says perhaps it was an oversight, is that this money doesn't belong to you, and you should return the amount that you were supposed to pay the first time for the goods. And I think this is a really important point, you know, as Christians. You know, a lot of times we can go to the store or something like that, and the checker gives you the wrong amount of change. And, you know, sometimes we'll say something like, oh, well, the Lord bless me, you know, this is terrific, you know, and you go off and like that. But that is not the way that we should view those types of things. We as Christians should, you know, conduct ourselves in an honest manner. You know, if you find out that the checker has given you too much change or whatever, even if you've gotten all the way home, you need to go back and give that money back because it doesn't belong to you. And so it would be like stealing. And the thing of the reality of it is, I mean, you wouldn't do it because of this necessarily, but the reality is that it could provide an opportunity for a witness before men. And this is in many ways a perfect example of something that I always talk about. Like I always say how, you know, as Christians, you know, we know about how we're supposed to be salt and light in this world. And so we sometimes seek ways to be salty or, you know, to be like light, and we'll do crazy things. Like, you know, we'll go and try to you know, bring attention to ourselves by saying different things or doing certain things, and, you know, to create this saltiness or whatever. But it's things like this. It's just the simplicity of doing things God's way, the simplicity of you being overpaid, you know, getting too much change and going back and saying, oh, you gave me too much, and being honest. That is being salt and light in this world, because that's not what the world does. And so it stands out, and it would cause that checker to say, man, there's something different about this person. they may even ask you, like, why did you bring it back? Like, you know, I wouldn't have thought that anyone would bring back extra change. And then you'd have an opportunity to share your faith. And then he goes on to say, and now take your brother also and go back to this man and so forth. And you can look at that and think, well, now maybe he's just engaging in fatalism. He's just going, you know, just go ahead. You know, even like you look at the last part of verse 14, he goes, if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. You know, if you know, Benjamin dies too, and everything just continues to go, you know, down the tubes, then so be it. You know, who cares? I'm just, you know, throwing, you know, caution to the wind or whatever. But no, what's happened here is that he has made a shift here. Before, he was basically holding on and saying, no way, I'm not doing that again. I'm not going to let this son go again. But now he's moved to a point of being and trusting in God. And this is really, really a significant thing, right? Because he's trusting the Lord in an area where he's felt like he's had been burned in the past, essentially. You know, so in other words, this is really a big thing for him, a real big growth thing. And it's a thing that for all of us, we despite what happens to us in the past, it's important that we continue to keep our trust in the Lord. So for instance, you know, you may have had a bad experience with something, right? You may have, you know, maybe you have gone and you have witnessed to somebody. You go and you talk, you share your faith with somebody, and it was a very, you know, traumatic, embarrassing, humbling experience. And so you may say, I'm not doing that again. And I'm not going to face up to that again. Or maybe you go on a mission trip or something, and you have a terrible experience. It was uncomfortable. You got sick, or you were harmed, or something like that. And you say, "Hey, I'm not going down that road ever again." But the reality is that he's overcome that. You know, he doesn't have, for a period of time, he had an area in his life that was off limits to God. So in other words, I will trust you, Lord, with everything that you want me to do, except for this one thing, okay? He was guarding that one little thing, which was the son that he loved, right? Because he had lost his other son that he loved. And he's like, I'm not going there. And so, you know, this is something for all of us, for me, for everyone to examine in our lives, like, do we have anything in our lives that we are kind of holding back and saying, that's just not, I just can't go there. I can't, like, I can do, you ask me to do anything else, but I can't do that, you know? And the way that he dealt with it here is in verse 14 is that he remembered, he says, may God Almighty, that's who he refers to here. He says, the all-powerful one, may he, the one who has all power, may he give you mercy. So we have this man that he's heard about that was unmerciful in his mind. He was a tough, you know, a tyrant type of guy. And he's saying, may God Almighty, the all-powerful one, the one who has all mercy, may that mercy be so great that it would swallow up what this other guy is doing. And so he just completely commits this to God. And he says, you know, may that he may release your other brother, Simeon, as well as Benjamin. And so then verse 15, it says, so the men took that present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand and arose and went down to Egypt. And they stood before Joseph. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready for these men, for these men will dine with me at noon. And so right off the bat, Joseph looks, he sees his brothers there, and he is very pleased with that, and he says, good. I'm going to have these people over to my house, and we're going to have a meal. This is great. And so he tells the steward to do this and to make the dinner, they're going to have this meal at noontime. And he goes on to about his business. He's a busy man. And so he goes off, and then now let's see what happens. Verse 17, it says, then the man did as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house, and they said, is it because of the money which we returned, which was returned in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may make a case against us and seize us to take us as slaves with our donkeys? And so, you know, they actually, instead of seeing this as a positive thing, like, oh, wow, we get to go and have this meal or whatever, they're just thinking, oh, my gosh, here we go again. This is going to be a terrible situation. They were just thinking, like, what was it? Was it the money in the sacks? Was it this? Was it that? You know? And so verse 19, it says, when they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house and said, oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came to the encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, so we have brought it back in our hand. And so here what's going on is that, you know, Joseph's not there, and they're feeling bad, feeling like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a bad thing. And so they try to solve this thing beforehand. Like, maybe, you know, Joseph doesn't understand what happened, and he doesn't understand that we brought back the money, and we want to do things right or whatever. So if we tell this guy, then maybe he can tell Joseph, so that, you know, kind of deal with the problem ahead of time, you know. And here's what takes place. Verse 22, it says, and we brought down other money in our hands to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks. Verse 23, but he said, peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. Then he brought Simeon out to them. So this steward, this man, he gives them comfort. He says, hey, don't worry. You're okay. You're good. And he brings out Simeon, another sign that you know, things are going well. Now, this whole thing with Simeon being brought out, you don't see anything here about, you know, Simeon like saying, like, what what took you guys so long? You know, why were you guys there for so long? I had to stay here. Simeon probably realized that when he got taken and put into prison under the condition that, you know, you will not be released unless the youngest son comes here, Simeon probably easily just resolved it within himself. There's no way I'm getting out. There's no way I'm getting out of prison, because my father, there's no way he's going to let Benjamin go. So he's basically now, he's probably coming. He's very happy. They're probably high-fiving and everything else. He didn't have any animosity towards them, probably, given the whole situation. Verse 24, so the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and they gave he gave their donkeys feed. Then they made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, for they heard that they would eat bread there. So we see even more signs that things are good, right? They're giving them water to drink and washing their feet, which is something that would demonstrate that they were honored guests here. And also feeding their donkeys. Verse 26, and when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed down before him to the earth. So we see again that dream of Joseph fulfilled, them bowing down before him. Then he asked them about their well-being and said, is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? So you see here that that, you know, that was weighing heavily on Joseph's mind, because, you know, he's putting them to this test, right? And he is, you know, using all of these circumstances to answer all these questions and stuff. But he also is very mindful of the fact that his father is old. And so he doesn't have a lot of time. You know, his father, you know, could have died in between the time that they left and the time that they came back. And so he wants to know that right off the bat. You know, is your father still alive? And it says they answered, yes, your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive. And then they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. And so we see again the dream fulfilled. Verse 29, then he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. And he said, is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. And so here he sees his brother, the one that he wanted to see. And it says his mother's son, meaning this is his full brother, right? Mother and father. And then he's playing it cool, right? Oh, is this your brother here that you told me about, you know? And, but yet we see what his heart is really, what's going on in his heart. Verse 30, it says, now his heart yearned for his brother. So he made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber and wept there. So we can see that there was a lot of emotion going on in him. He was trying to play it cool. But the reality is that he really wanted to just run over and just hug his brother, Benjamin. But it was too early at this point to reveal his identity. He wanted to keep that secret because there were still some more tests that he wanted to do. Verse 31, it says, then he washed his face and came out, and he restrained himself and said, serve the bread. So, you know, again, he was crying, his eyes were probably red and watery, and so he wanted to do something to kind of hide that. And so, you know, he washed his face. It's something that you know, we all can do if we're crying and we don't want people to know about it. So you just wash your face so that, you know, your whole face is wet. And so, you know, people say, what's going on with you? And he's like, oh, well, you know, just wanted to wash my face, you know. Verse 32, it says, so they set him a place by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. And so we can see that there were these three separate groupings of people here. One, we had Joseph there all by himself. Then we had the Egyptians who were by themselves. They were likely of a class of people that weren't of a high enough class to be sitting there with Joseph, but Egyptians thought they were better than Hebrews, so they couldn't sit with the Hebrews. And then the Hebrews were there by themselves as well. Verse 33, and they sat before him, the firstborn, according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth, and the men looked in astonishment at one another. And so here we see the tremendous wisdom of Joseph, but to them, they just thought, man, this place, Egypt, is really amazing. How could they have known? This did not go unnoticed by them, because it says that they looked astonished. But basically what they're saying is that it took the oldest of the brothers that were there, and they put him first, and then the next oldest, and the next oldest, all the way down to the youngest. And the odds of that, the odds of someone who didn't know about this setting him up that way is 40 million to one. Okay, so this was a very profound thing that was going on, and it was communicating to them that there was a tremendous something going on here, that God truly was in all of this. And you know, one of the things I forgot to mention before, you know, just in terms of just talking about the kind of the wisdom that the Lord gave to Joseph, and I think we see this throughout the entire Bible, right? The wisdom of God, you know, on display. You see it especially in Jesus when he was, you know, was there on the earth interacting with people, answering questions, asking questions of people, like his tremendous wisdom. But you know, going back to that whole thing of, you know, creating that pressure on the family to come back and everything, there's so much wisdom in all of that. So for instance, when Joseph gave them their money back, that was a very wise thing, because he didn't know anything about the condition or the wealth of his family back in Canaan. So when those brothers came and they bought that grain the first time, he didn't know if they were spending their last money or if they had more money. So he wanted to not only give them grain so that he can take it back to take care of the people for a time, but he also gave them money back so that they wouldn't have money as an excuse for not coming back, right? Because, you know, as terrible as they were in the past, they came from an honorable family, right? And you know, Jacob, you know, Israel being the head of that family, if they didn't have the money, they wouldn't go back and try to, you know, put one over on Egypt or whatever, right? So that was a wise thing. The second thing is that by holding Simeon, he ended up having a twofold benefit, okay? One, it was something that would make them want to come back so that they would spare his life. So they had that tug on them. But secondly, if they did not come back, he could use Simeon as a human GPS system, right? To basically take him where the family lived there in Canaan. So he could just say, lead me back to your family, and he would be able to get there. So it was just amazing just how you know, the Lord gave Joseph all this wisdom to figure all this stuff out and to do all these different things to bring all this together, to bring out the guilt in these guys and to allow that to be dealt with, to basically get the family to Egypt and to fulfill God's plan. And so the last verse here, verse 34, it says, then he took servings to them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was five times as much as any of theirs. So they drank and were merry with him. So this seems just like a, you know, just a simple verse here, but this was a really important test that that Joseph was doing in them. He really wanted to know, are these guys the same guys? Because these were jealous men, right? These were men who were envious. Because remember how Joseph was the favorite of his father Jacob, and Jacob didn't make any attempt to hide that. And so here, he's doing the same thing. He is, in a very obvious way, he's showing favoritism to Benjamin, and he wants to see, are they going to be envious? Are they going to look at him and say, look at him, why is he getting all this food? Get some of that food and give it to the other people or whatever. He really wanted to provoke jealousy in them so that he could see, you know, are they changed men? And he got his answer, didn't he? Because not only did they not say anything about it or treat Benjamin unfavorably, they just drank and they were happy. They were just merry. They just didn't even make anything of it. And so, you know, that is really an amazing thing. And it's kind of one of the things that it reminded me of how, you know, just over time, you know, how things can change in our walk with the Lord. You know, a long time ago, I don't remember what I was teaching in particular, but I was talking about how, like, you know, before I came to Christ, I used to use profanity, you know, in my normal speech. And even as I grew up, you know, I became a Christian at age 16, you know, and so as I, you know, lived out my life and around other people and stuff like that, you know, I was a man who used profanity, but over time, the Lord changed me in that way, you know, and it was one of those things where you go from the part of using profanity, right, to the point where you're not using it, right, but yet you might be thinking it in your mind or in your heart, and then you come to the point where it's not even there. It's absent from your mind. It's absent from your heart. You know, it's not something that is going to come up. Like if you drop a hammer on your toe or something like that, it's just going to come out because it's not there. And along the way, I mean, you know, that's just one small example, but there are many different examples that we all have in our lives as Christians. It's really amazing when sometimes you can stop and go, wow, you know, I would have done that differently. I would have, you know, said a curse word, or I would have been jealous, or I would have been envious, or I would have done whatever. And it's just amazing to see how, like, it didn't even faze them. You know, they were just like, you know, just kept on, you know, drinking and having a good time and just being happy and joyful that the Lord was blessing the situation. So in any event, we'll stop right there. Again, this is, for me, this is just an amazing story. It's very rich. And next week, we're, Lord willing, we're going to see how this all comes together. This whole story is going to come to a very amazing and blessed end. And we're going to see how the Lord was involved in all of it, and it was for the good of the whole family, even though it initially was quite bad for Joseph. So let's close in prayer, and we will pick up where we left off next week.